Hey, everybody. Welcome in. My name is Kara Burrell. Sometimes I go by Nuanceo, and sometimes I interview very fascinating people across the spectrum of the ex-Mormon community. And today we're getting into sassy broads, white supremacist backgrounds. You know the one. Jenny Gage from Life Take Two, the one and only most, I think that's pretty much what you're known for at this point. Undo the horrifying past that you once had as a Mormon trad wife. My mind goes to you, Jenny. So thank you for being here and telling us about what your journey has been.
Thank you. And that's so accurate. It's nice to talk to you because I feel like you're someone who we've watched each other. I feel like you're someone who we've watched each other. You kind of know me. So you just hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. Like what I have such a similar background to you, but I've not been bold enough to want to talk about it. And I'm getting more bolder by wanting to talk about my family being of a certain persuasion. I don't want to hurt the relationships that I have with them, but I also want to be honest about the influences that I had in Mormonism and in a very, very conservative, you know, currently kind of MAGA household. I have a brother who was arrested by the FBI for being a white supremacist. He was there at January 6th. So like, I don't like talking about that because I don't want to sound like, I don't like confronting my own past. And I don't like hurting my family's feelings, but you're really bold. And I really appreciate that. That's so needed right now. So I really, really, really appreciate your content. Hope people will tune in for this interview.
Thank you. And can I just tell you something that I don't think that you know? And I was really excited to talk to you today. Yes. Because I've never mentioned this to you and there's no way that you would possibly know this. And first of all, I have to say that one of the things that emboldens me is the fact that I know there's so many people out there who are living through these things, whether it's domestic violence that I address, whether it's religious trauma and abuse at the hands of priesthood leaders and people around them that are supposed to be, you know, those the people that uplift them and protect them, right? Whatever topic it is that I'm addressing in the moment, I very much feel the weight of those who either don't have a microphone or aren't able to use their voices to share their own stories. So every time I do a video, every time I do an interview, I'm always thinking of, I know there's a million people out there who've been through this. I'm the one with the microphone. So Kara, I'm telling your story too, but little funny detail, way back during the pandemic, I'm just a grandma. I don't know how to use electronics. I can't record things. I was really sick, right? I had an anoxic brain injury. I was bedbound and homebound. So my teenagers are like, hey, mom, let's put TikTok on your phone so you have something to do. So they put TikTok on my phone and I found one ex-Mormon on TikTok. It was Mitch Shira. He's doing his little Thomas Monson things, right? And he inspired me so much that one day I had my little, what was he, 9 or 10 at the time? I had my little son like, hey, Brody, can you show me how to record a TikTok video?
Look,
that was my
now.
Very first, like, hi, I want to know why I was homeless and destitute because my Mormon stake president told me to be a stay-at-home mom. So I post that video and then you were the very next person. The algorithm just brought me this Nuanceo. You were the second ex-Mormon that I ever saw. And Kara, you inspired me. It's like, hey, this is a thing. And you're the first person that I saw that little hashtag XMO, XLDS.
Aww.
And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this. So
that's so like, nice.
We're out there pioneering. You know, nobody was out there. People weren't doing stuff. We were literally inventing this sphere of community and ex-Mormon TikTok. So now I have 500,000, half a million followers between my two platforms. And I reach millions a month. And you are one of the reasons why.
Great. My address is, and my check will be coming when, I'm just kidding. I feel the exact same way about so many creators that kind of inspired me. That's so sweet. That's so nice to hear. That's always kind of the mission, is that I won't be able to like keep the torch going at all times. Like I have to kind of be in and out of making content and raising my kids. They're still little and going through my own, you know, separation, moving and stuff. But like, it's so good to hear that you're thinking about other people, trying to be a voice for them, because you're being a voice for me now. We're kind of taking turns because you're saying so many of the things that I can't say. But I'd
I
like
feel
to
like we're
get
all passing this
to
torch
say.
Around, right? Like in the ex-religious sphere, in the whatever it is that we're addressing, we're all just kind of passing the torch around from day to day. And that's a beautiful thing. So thank you for the part that you played in everything that I do. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I had a similar story too. I was kind of like bedridden after my son was born and they thought I had MS and I was just not functioning at all. And I also downloaded TikTok just as something to do. And I was like, hey, I saw other content creators and I was like, I could do this. And then here I am. And it took over my whole life.
Here we are.
Yeah. So your channel is Life Take Two.
Life Take Two.
All the platforms, Jenny Gage. So if somebody heads over to your channel, you've got some very eye-catching titles. I watched a few of your videos over the last few months, and then especially this last week. And you absolutely pull no punches talking about the translation that you see going on of as a former, like, very devoutly white supremacist person, like what you think is going on in our country, what people like Stephen Miller are really saying, what kind of dog whistles are going on. So I just want to read some of the titles of your videos. So MAGA destroyed my life, how I escaped MAGA, critical thinking woke me up. The white people want us gone, former white supremacist responds to Stephen Miller, why I left MAGA. So as just a quick introduction, if you were to describe yourself, not to people who might be in my audience who kind of are already listening and engaged, but how would you pitch yourself to somebody who needs to kind of wake up to what's happening right now? How do you express your views and say, this is what I used to believe, this is what I believe now, without just offending people and making them feel like you're calling them out for being racist? You're saying, well, if I voted conservative, if I voted MAGA, that means I'm X, Y, and Z. Like, how do you try to engage in those conversations?
That's a great question, Kara. I'm not thinking about the other people most of the time. When I write my content, you know, I'm up at like 4 o'clock in the morning just thinking about my former life. And I'm a 51-year-old grandma who's had two very different lives. That's why I'm called Life Take Two, right? Mm-hmm. I was raised ultra-conservative, LDS, and then after I left the Mormon church at age 44, went hardcore into evangelical Christianity and went from being a trad wife to being divorced to now being in a very equal partnership. So I don't think that it's possible for most people to have two such polarizing experiences. My entire world crumbled to the ground. I don't have the same name, the same pet, the same house, the same anything. Everything completely changed. And when I'm sharing white supremacy, when I'm sharing Christian nationalism and just some of the real toxic things, yes, I'm aware that there's a movement out there, but I'm not typically focused on them. I'm not focused on my MAGA neighbors down the street. I'm not focused even on my family. I'm sharing what I went through and the experience that I had. And this is with a lot of deconstruction, a lot of insight. Now, if you had asked me 8 years ago about Donald Trump, about brown-skinned people, about the purpose and the vision of America, I would have said, Heavenly Father created America. It's a special land. It's so special that the Garden of Eden was in Missouri, in Jackson County, Missouri, right? Mm-hmm. And he had a plan for this land, and that plan was only for his chosen people, and they were all white. You know, the white people that came out from Jerusalem that were Lehi and Nephi and his family and the peoples of the Book of Mormon, and the white colonists that Christopher Columbus was inspired. And Heavenly Father had this divine plan for the United States of America, which would culminate eventually when Jesus Christ comes back, not to Israel, Jerusalem, but to Jackson County, Missouri, the seat of the Garden of Eden. And I would have told you that everything going on with Africa, famines in Ethiopia, things like that from my childhood, that was because those people were cursed. And I wouldn't have thought that there was anything wrong with that. If you had interviewed me 8 years ago, I would have said, this is just the way that it is. This is Heavenly Father's plan, and I'm the good guy. Mm-hmm. Now, because I'm able to look in that rearview mirror, what I want everyone to hear, whether you're ultra alt-right, some of my cousins who've sold their homes and are prepping and waiting for Jesus to come back and the end to come, or if you're mm-hmm. some of my lesbian liberal friends, I just want people to hear that I feel that the way that I viewed the world and interacted in it was harmful to me, harmful to everybody around me. And in culmination, as I engaged in my Mormon community and my alt-right family, and then the larger MAGA, harmful to America and the world. And I feel like I have fought really hard for 7 years to get to a better place and be a better person. And my life is a million times better and I'm happier than I've ever been. So it's not always about everything else. It's just about me. I was a jerk.
Let me run this idea by you and I want to hear your thoughts. So one way that I've been trying to bridge the gap is by getting right to the core of what I think we should all be able to kind of agree on in this country, where it's not MAGA thinking that liberals are the problem with America and not just liberals thinking that MAGA and Donald Trump. It's the wider issues of who's controlling the levers of democracy right now. And to me, that is special interest groups. That's bubbles of foreign countries and foreign entities that want to interfere in our elections. And that's special interest groups of companies. That's the religious white nationalist alt-right that have their own theocracy, their own agenda. That's Peter Thiel, JD Vance, and these dark MAGA tech bros. And so I am familiar, you're more familiar with the white nationalist portion of that that special interest group. And every special interest group needs to have propaganda that enables them to keep people docile, to keep people emboldened, to think that they're part of something while also taking away their rights and the morality and slipping out the back door. And so I see our government right now working for just about everybody except for the good of the people. So, you know, when I was extremely conservative, I stood outside in the morning at 6 a.m. for Ben Shapiro. I listened to Steven Crowder and Gavin McGinnis every day. Like, I had a lot of alt-right ideas. I was an anti-feminist for a long time. I worked for a super conservative nonprofit, but I think I was very young and influenced by, I'm starting with Mormonism is right. So as long as I am in that camp, anything I believe that is kosher within Mormonism is still going to be fine, without realizing that I was just being propagandized to by tools of a white nationalist agenda. And whatever people are kind of interested in, like the overarching picture seems to me that it's special interest groups, specifically white nationalists, who are emboldened right now. And that's what I want to use my expertise and talk to you today kind of about, of how we break down that propaganda and get people to fight for the rights of ourselves and the rights of others.
Sure.
That's my mission statement.
I love that. Kara, you're such a brilliant, insightful person. Like, that's one thing I've always appreciated about you. You're a deep thinker.
I
think that's very accurate.
I've made Mormon content that's silly in a lot of different ways and stuff. And I feel like Mormonism, we can kind of gawk at the clown show of what's going on. And there's just different content creators who have different niches, and it's all valuable and all provides something. But I think that the state of the country right now, I'm not going to pretend that I'm comfortable with it if I have a platform anymore. I'm going to say, what can we all agree on? And it's, people want us to hate each other right now. And
totally, like,
after the Charlie Kirk shooting, Charlie Kirk shooting, the number one thing I said to myself is, they want us to be divided right now. They want us to hate each other. And I will not hate my countryman right now. I will not. I want, even if MAGA people want me to cry and whine and I want them to have healthcare. I still want them to have a living wage. I don't want them to send their sons and daughters to fight in foreign offensive and ridiculous wars that cost us trillions of dollars. I don't want any of that. I still want people to have rights. And if I have a platform, I want to find how we can talk about that. And without people being like, okay, libtard, on to the next video. I'm like, you can call me all the names you want. I still want you to have the best, most fulfilling life and access to democracy in this country. So that's my mission statement, you know?
I think that as human beings, we're easily lured into different like paths, right? And that's just basic marketing. And we always think that we're going to see the bad guys. We're going to know when we're being manipulated. We're going to know when we're being exploited, because it's going to be really obvious. When I was a young mom, we went through like this FBI little mini thing. I don't even know where it was. It was some little parents meeting. It was probably like a stake activity. I don't even know. But they had some people from the FBI come in, and then we could have all our kids fingerprinted and store those, you know, at home in case they ever get abducted. And then they did this little kidnapping training thing, right? So my kids were kidnap trained. And then one day we go to the park, and my like 4-year-old son sees this guy sitting at a table covered in tattoos. He was just at the park and he was like writing in a notebook. And when I'm not looking, my son runs up to him and like 4 minutes later, he's just sitting there like eating a sandwich with the guy. And it's like, wait, you just let a stranger who literally had tattoos on his head and everywhere just give you a sandwich. And like, this guy could be a kidnapper, Mace. And Mason's like, no way, he's a cool guy, Mom. And that was just such a lesson for life, because often it is the cool guys. It's the people that are selling something really neat, that have the tastiest sandwich, that we get lured towards without realizing that they're trying to just stick us in the van and wheel us off. I don't think that most of us see this beautiful, you know, this uniform face that the White House is putting out, and we want families and we're supporting marriage and let's make America great again. A lot of people, obviously, Donald Trump was voted into office, get lured in by that and like, oh, this is amazing. And they don't see any of the stuff behind the scenes. They don't see what these people in power are actually trying to do. And the result of that is we do get sucked into things, and there's so much division. As a feminist, and I'm very outspoken on my channel about women's rights, about women's roles, about what makes a happy woman, what makes an unhappy woman, and the risks that we have associated with leaning into traditional families, traditional lifestyles. I have so many people just hate me. I mean, Kara, I'm sure you've dealt with it too. I've had death threats. I've had stalkers. I just, you know, in my comment section, just people telling me that feminism is to blame. Feminism is the reason that America is in decline. I'm actually posting a video to my channel today that I do a response to a very racist white supremacist little blonde girl who has a huge social media following. And she's like, it's the brown people. That's why America's in decline. We're completely unraveling because of the brown people. It's not the brown people. It's not the feminists. It's capitalism, the way that it's done in America. It's the greedy people who are trying to take power, and they want us to be fighting with each other because what they need is a voting base. So if everybody in MAGA, if everybody who loves Erica Kirk and thinks that she's the queen bee of all the Christians, and everybody who's following Trump, if they hate purple-haired no-kingers, if they hate lesbians and feminists and whatever, then they're going to vote for Donald Trump. And that's what he wants. They want the power. They want the money.
Yeah. And I look forward to your debunking of somebody saying that brown people are the problem and feminists are the problem. I definitely remember having those types of thoughts, even if I didn't always say them out loud. But there is this type of like rage bait farming, like one-upping of each other. I wanted to ask if you've kind of noticed this online, where people are just more bold saying things. Like, there's a Christian podcaster I watched today, and he said that it's time to bring slavery back. And if you got a problem with that, Christians, you're not a real Christian. It's slavery. It's in the Bible. It's time we bring slavery back. And I'm almost not surprised. Being a terrible person is now the edgiest, coolest thing that you can do. Like, I saw your video about the MAGA group chat from the quote unquote young Republicans, or I call them 40-year-old Republicans group chat that got leaked, talking about, you know, like, I love Hitler, we need the gas chambers, you know, rape is epic, all of those things that they're saying it like they're joking, but also serious. But it really doesn't matter, because being a terrible person around other terrible people is its own kind of like social capital now, of like who can say the most edgy thing and like piss off the libs. And like, we've lost any meaningful, like we've lost all meaningful discourse because of who our president is, putting out AI videos of dumping shit all over Americans. Like, you can't even get a job at the mall if you have too many bikini pics on your Instagram, but the president can drop, you know, loads of shit on its people. Like, there is this attitude towards people forgetting that there's a human being on the other side of the screen, unless it's a bot. We're forgetting that, like, that there are actual people who we share a country with. And unless we want some kind of national divorce, like, the decorum and the conversations are just devolving into stuff that I thought that we ended with World War II, right? So I'm curious what your thoughts are on what is going on with people just being so entertained by being so terrible.
Yeah, first, I've seen that so much. You know, I've been on social media for almost 7 years now. And yeah, like, you'll get your comments. People bully me, you know, like, your eyebrows are crooked and you have a chubby face and whatever. Like, you get bullied for stuff. But during the election, all of a sudden, the majority of my comments were just the most despicable things that I've ever seen. In the past couple of weeks, I've had to report a couple of death threats. And the one that cracked me up was, and it was really specific. And then I had a stalker who had my address, who was mailing me stuff. And these are all Trump people. These are all Christians. These are all like, ah, Jenny said she hates Charlie Cake, so Kirk, so we're going to go after her. But the one death threat that actually like was terrifying, reported to the FBI and everything and my local sheriff, but then also like made me kind of giggle, was he like quoted Donald Trump, you know, like, you are a vile vermin and you probably eat cats and dogs for breakfast. And then he specifically told me that he was going to drive to Tucson, Arizona, drag me out into the street and rape me until my intestines bled out my back. And he goes, and that's what you deserve, you liberal feminist whore. I never got stuff like that until Donald Trump was in office. And a lot of that, I think, is just basic human psychology. We are subconscious dominant. Monkey see, monkey do, right? Is a really easy way to explain it. So yeah, like if somebody's like wearing this pink t-shirt, all of a sudden, like we don't pick up on it, but we're like, huh, pink t-shirt. We go to the mall next time and we're buying that hot pink t-shirt. We are very subconscious dominant. We see things, we don't even have to like logically process them. We'll just do it. And gone are the days of like, the president says, I will not, you know, I chop down the cherry tree, dad. I confess here, you know, George Washington, take my axe and go throw it in the garbage because I'm a bad boy. Now we have at the top of the American leadership, we have Donald Trump and these truly despicable people. J.D. Vance defending, I love, what do you call them? The 40-year-old Republicans.
Yeah. These are kids.
These are kids.
Kids do crazy things. Also, Charlie Kirk, if anyone plays clips of what Donald Trump said about Charlie Kirk, find their employer, fire them. But these kids that work for us, kids, 40-year-old kids. Yeah.
So monkey see, monkey do. We're all just kind of subliminally picking up on that. So all of the hateful people who were thinking hateful thoughts already, who are afraid of other humans and just, you know, they want to spew toxicity out, they are just subliminally picking up on that and like, oh, J.D. Vance and Donald Trump and everybody else is doing that. So there was recently a picture of, what's her face, Sweeney, in Vogue.
Sydney Sweeney?
Was it? Yeah. Or was it Coach or somebody? I don't know. I saw it pop up. She was, you know, another modeling picture where she's like virtually naked except for a pair of boots. Might have been Louis Vuitton or something. And just the comment section of all of these guys and every profile that I picked on was like some guy with a beard and like a chihuahua under his arm and like the American flag in the background, you know, the type. And the comments are just like, baby, like I would eat your jeans for breakfast. Just, you know, the whole great jeans and white girls are better. And they were just saying it out there in the open. I've never seen that in my entire life. I'm 51. I've never seen this level of racism and weirdness ever, Kara. But monkey see, monkey do.
Yep, I think that's a good explanation for it. And I wish I could say, not my circus, not my monkeys, but as many as I have so many friends, I know so many friends who don't have kids and they're able to leave the country right now. And I'm like, I will stay with this ship. Okay. Just got to learn some self-regulation and do what I can and use my voice and try to raise good kids. Have you seen that one TikTok channel that's been blowing up of that mom who sits her little boys kind of in front of Charlie Kirk talking points or whoever?
Yes.
And says like
immunize your kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are that I wish would go more viral. It's so wonderful. And the son can debunk like, why does he want you to hate feminists? He's like, oh, but, and he's like probably 10 or 12 and like understands that there's somebody out there who benefits from him hating other people, from hating, you know, people of color and women
she's
and stuff.
So great.
And
will you link that in your description so other people can watch that?
Yeah.
She is so good.
Yep. So I want to get into your story a little bit.
Right.
So at some point, Jenny, your faith in Mormonism, your worldview about your race started to unravel. So before that happened, will you kind of take us through what being a good Mormon woman meant to you growing up, what that was supposed to look like, and then what your influences were to kind of mold you into the person that you became as an adult for your first half of life?
Love this question. I was born and raised into one of these beautiful, idyllic, on the outside Mormon families with these beautiful trad wives, so traditional. And I'm a little bit older. You know, on my TikToks, when I talk about ex-Mormon stuff, I have so many people, I'm like, Jenny, that didn't happen. Well, yeah, it did, because I'm 51. So back in the 70s and 80s and the 90s when I was growing up, like, that's what we were doing. So super old school, super conservative. And I will say that, like, my growing up years were kind of like a tale of two cities, because on the one hand, it's like, oh, this was such a beautiful, magical life. I ate homemade sourdough bread, and half of our backyard was a garden, and we'd have family home evenings on Monday nights and go to church all the time. And, you know, we had this beautiful blonde. I was the oldest of five kids, beautiful family, and it looked so great. But then on the inside, we were poverty stricken. My whole entire life was just daily guilt and fear of things that I was doing. Even, you know, from the time I was 8 years old and got baptized and then punched my sister the next day. And I had this thought of, oh, I'm going to hell. I just got baptized, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely best of times, worst of times.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Arizona and Oregon. My dad was from Oregon. My mom was from Arizona. So kind of half and half, we went back and forth a lot of my life in Scottsdale, Arizona. And, you know, heavy Mormon influence. My influences were definitely like the most conservative of people. My grandmother, she was the matron in the temple. My great grandmother had moved right across the street from the Mesa, Arizona temple so that she could spend every bloody minute of her life just in the temple, doing temple work. And, you know, women like Jackie Kennedy, she was one of my heroes. She was one of my influences. But this wouldn't actually influence me until years later, like right now. I also read a lot of books and had a public school education, and I was so inspired by Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman and Marilyn Monroe. Just, she was sexy, she was sassy, she made an incredible career for herself. Madonna came out when I was in like middle school, and as a little Mormon girl, she maybe kind of like polluted my brain a little bit with, again, just a strong woman raising her voice and being a little bit irreverent. But certainly as I entered adulthood and got married and became a stay-at-home mom myself, it was like Barbara Bush and then Laura Bush. And I was ultra conservative. Like, I was the good girl. Never had a drink of alcohol until I left the Mormon church at age 44. Never smoked a cigarette, none of that stuff. Just trying to choose right and embrace being a daughter of my Heavenly Father who loved me.
Mm-hmm. So what were the first ideas that you learned about race, whether directly inside the church or from your family?
Well, I was born when Black people could not go to the temple. So right. I remember the controversy that was. And even as like a young child in elementary school, just conversations that happened inside of our home, you know, grandparents, my mom, just people in the ward, just kind of questioning whether or not the prophet, President Kimball at the time, was crazy. I have a Substack article on the topic, and I've lifted the paywall on it so people can read it for free. It's just simply entitled, I Was a White Supremacist. And it was an article that I wrote just over a year ago as I was deconstructing, like, wow, I wasn't a skinhead, I wasn't a Nazi, but absolutely my entire life was egregious white supremacy. I remember as a really young girl, and we had primary on Wednesdays, right? We didn't have Sunday primary. We had Wednesday primary. You just go down and you had the youth group like in the afternoon. And I remember our primary president that day teaching us from the Book of Mormon about Laman and Lemuel and Nephi, and how Laman and Lemuel were these bad brothers and they were cursed. And so Heavenly Father made their skin black. And she just point blank said, that's why the Indians have brown skin, because they're cursed. And that's why Black people have black skin, because they're cursed. And she taught us just a little bit about the preexistence and unrighteousness. And then to kind of really like emotionally seal us to that ideology, they taught us Book of Mormon stories. And like, you remember like the whole, the racist hand motions that went with it. So I was, I don't know how old I was, maybe 4 years old. Yeah. Like Book of Mormon stories are about the Lamanites in ancient history. Long ago, their fathers came from far across the street, the whole thing. And that changed the way that I thought about everything. Now, I was raised for part of my childhood in northern Arizona in the middle of Navajo reservations, surrounded by Navajo reservations. And I had been so curious about the Navajos that for a few Halloweens in a row, I dressed like an Indian princess. My dad was a journalist. We had to go to powwows from time to time. Have you ever been to a Navajo powwow?
I have not.
10 out of 10 recommend.
Yeah.
They're incredible. And as a young girl, the powwows were the most magical thing. It was like the Navajo powwows and Wonder Woman. Those were the things that just inspired me as a young girl. And then I learned this primary lesson. And the next time we're driving around town, I see a Navajo man just like sitting on a bench. And I was instantly afraid of him. I thought, oh no. That's one of the bad guys. And as a child, like I didn't even have concept of like time frame. Like the Book of Mormon was supposed to have been like what, almost 2000, you know, 2000 plus years ago, right?
Yeah.
2600 years ago. Sorry, it's been so long since I've been in the church. I'm forgetting my timeline. But mm-hmm. like to me, it's like that could have just happened like 10 years ago. This guy could be Laman and Lemuel. I didn't have that concept of time. All I knew is that I had been taught that African Americans and the Native Americans were cursed, that they were dangerous, that they were disgusting. Not only were they bad in this life, but in the pre-existence before we came to Earth, mm-hmm. they had all been bad and they listened to Satan. They listened to Satan there, they listened to Satan here. And so I didn't want to have anything to do with them. I remember in like first or second grade then, There was this family that the little daughter started going to my elementary school because they were migrant workers. They were, a Mexican farm family that just came during the school year to work some mm-hmm. of the Christmas tree farms around us. I'd moved up to Portland by then. And her name was Ernestina. And like, as she's introducing herself in class and I don't know, like second, third grade, the first thing I could think, like, we're all white, you know, a lot of German people in Portland. And she's this Mexican migrant worker's daughter. And as a second grader, as like a seven-year-old, I'm thinking, oh, ick. Like she has brown skin. She's cursed. She's one of the bad guys. So I better not play with her. And mm-hmm. the funny thing is, like in hindsight, she was so interesting. She was gorgeous. But I just knew I'm better than her. I'm chosen. God made me white for a reason. Heavenly Father was white. Jesus Christ was white. You've gone to the temple when I was a young newlywed. Eve was white. Every picture that I ever saw, if they had a little primary program and they did Adam and Eve, they'd show that picture of blonde Adam, mm-hmm. blonde Eve, and their little animal skin standing by the altar in the Garden of Eden. Like white, blonde, blue-eyed was the mm-hmm. ideal. We were better people. That's how God had marked us as the superior race. And that flavored my life from childhood onward. When I became an adult, I think it got even more toxic. And I just did a video on like the different flavors. So no, I wasn't a Nazi. I wasn't out burning down people's houses. But I would sometimes vote for legislation that would harm people. I remember when the famine was going on in Ethiopia and, you know, you could send money. And I'm like, we probably shouldn't because they're just cursed. Like, that's why they're dying. Children are dying because they're cursed people. And I certainly didn't like my children to have like Latina school teachers. I would make sure that they had the white Mormon every year. I would put in the little request for teachers and I avoided it. Mm-hmm. And honestly, until Kara, I actually hate talking about this stuff, but until I left the church at age 44, which was just 7 years ago, this month, like I just celebrated my 7 year anniversary of leaving the Mormon church. Until 7 years ago, the only people in my life that had brown skin at all were my housekeepers, my landscapers.
The guys. And that sends an explicit message to your children sometimes too, of like what these people exist in our society for, not as equals, but as, you know, below the poverty line.
Yep. I do some videos where I have my little Dixie flag pens and I just, I dug one. I found my old jewelry box. So my Mormonism, that whole, you know, they're cursed and Heavenly Father has a plan for his white kids, but not for the brown ones, those are the bad guys. that culminated when I moved to South Carolina. We stopped in Arkansas for a little bit while we were building a custom home. We moved to South Carolina and we became friends with the Klan. Like most of our neighbors were KKK.
That's insane.
Yeah. And this was like the year, like 2013, 2014, 2017. Like these people are still there. The store is still there. Everything, like the Klan is still a huge thing. Mm-hmm. My chiropractor was Klan and he's like, hey, you guys should join. This is, you know, it's great. We're doing really good things. We did not join the Klan. I'm really specific about that. But there was a church shooting in, I think it was 2015, 2016, while we lived in South Carolina. And the governor, Nikki Haley, decided because the white guy who went into the black church and committed this horrible murder of innocent people at Bible study, he had a Confederate flag on his truck. So this became this big controversial thing. So Governor Nikki Haley took down the Confederate flag that had flown at the state capitol, I think since the Civil War, right? There was always the South Carolina flag, the Confederate flag right next to it. And so she took that flag down. She's like, we're getting rid of the Confederate flag. And in order to show our unity, that we had white pride, everyone that I knew, like all of our neighbors, like we talked about it, right? And they're like, hey, run up to the store, which is owned by the Grand Wizard of the Klan, and make sure that you're buying, you know, we're going to show our white unity. We're going to protest this. So I bought a Dixie flag to fly on my minivan, like a little window insert. I had flags on my porch. I had Dixie flag bumper stickers. I had like a t-shirt and I had this little pin, this little Confederate flag mm-hmm. pin that I wore on my shirt every single day, everywhere I went. So I'd be in Walmart and the other white supremacists would be like, hey, Jenny, yeah, you know, that's how we identified each other. Kara, I chose to side with the perpetrator in that.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up an interesting question. So you've said you have a Substack article entitled, I Was a White Supremacist. And that's mm-hmm. something that kind of is what people know you for now, as a former racist and white supremacist. So that's obviously something that as you know, you and I have left the church, like I saw the racism in myself that I didn't realize was so explicit in, you know, the types of media I was listening to and types of people I was voting for and policies and just my whole brain. I wouldn't have thought of myself as a racist, but I can see myself now looking back as, you know, there's a spectrum, but I was definitely not where I am right now. Right. So how did you see yourself then? Because it's such an interesting nuanced dichotomy because to be like a good Christian Mormon in myself, I would never think that racism was part of the gospel. It was a different interpretation. It was a different word. It was just a different brain chemistry that even though I also believed that brown skinned people had a curse from God. And I was like, that's not me to judge. Like that's God did that. Like it is what it is. Like I wouldn't have called that racist, but now I can call that racist. So how did you view yourself then as like a good person, a Christian person, while also holding these views?
Right. Great question. So I wouldn't have described myself as a racist, just like you. I would have said, well, that's God. Like I'm just doing what God tells me to do. So in a way, I was just like a secondhand racist. But you know, if you've ever lived in a house with a dad or somebody who smokes cigarettes all the time, you can die of emphysema from the secondhand smoke just as much as you do. So maybe I didn't come to that conclusion myself. Maybe I didn't just wake up one day and be like, well, huh. Yeah, the Navajos in my community, they're terrible people. I hate them. And I'm going to do whatever I can to make their lives miserable and make sure I don't hang out with them. It's not like I came up with that on my own, but I was racist, blaming it on somebody else, which almost gave me like this feeling of separation. And it's a weird, weird space to be in, which is why I'm so opposed to childhood indoctrination. Like I actually look back on my young teenage self and the way that racism shaped so much of everything. And as an older, you know, a young mom and, you know, in my 30s and 40s and like not having any friends, like a Mexican family would move into my neighborhood and I wouldn't even really talk to them. Like I look back on how my life was so negatively impacted because I had been the victim of childhood indoctrination. And in many ways, it wasn't my choice. But yeah, I was a little racist puppet in the hands of the Mormon Church, the Book of Mormon, and really just Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith was one who put that in there. So I was a puppet in his hands, but I was still complicit.
And I think, yeah, part of like that indoctrination also has to do with what your community is, what your family is surrounded by. And being Mormon and growing up in Provo, Utah, I was not surrounded personally by a lot of people of different faiths, different beliefs, different skin colors, different sexual orientations. And so when you kind of just think like, this is God's manufactured standard of what a human being is, everyone else is kind of the off-brand, is how I would describe my worldview of like the standard set from God is exactly what we're doing right now. We're infiltrating them with our blonde hair and our black tops and our makeup. By the time I was an adult, I was still quite conservative and quite Republican and influenced, yes, by the ideas that are written by Bruce R. McConkie and Mormon Doctrine. I had that book, and it's kind of like, you want to know what the answers are to what's true and right. You flip open a page to Mormon Doctrine and you're like, all right, black people, what do I think about them? We're in heaven, fence sitters. All right, got it. Those are the words from God. Now I know what to plug in about what to think about those people. Very unfortunate about, you know, X, Y, and Z thing that they've had to deal with, but today is the 21st century and they should get over it kind of ideas, you know? So that, that was kind of, you know, a brief, you know, rambling overview of my upbringing. But one thing I wanted to specifically ask you is, with that being said, because I think we had, you know, similar with people being not so aware of how they are explicitly racist and how to kind of see that in themselves. And one thing that comes to mind is the way that white people will vote against their own best interests if it means that it's making sure that black people don't get what they're entitled to. I had a Sunday school teacher in high school, and after Hurricane Katrina, this like really stuck with me. He said in our Sunday school lesson, we were talking about Hurricane Katrina and how he just had so many racist things to say about the black people who are horribly affected by this natural disaster and then the failures horribly of FEMA affected. And so forth. And he said, the only thing, like, the, imagine being a young, impressionable 16-year-old, and the only thing I took away from Hurricane Katrina was that black people were getting Visa cards and using them to buy purses. And that's when, you know, when black people get a hold of any kind of entitlement or anything, they misuse it, they abuse it. So it's better to, basically the instinct was, it's better to have no welfare. Nobody gets anything from our tax dollars because brown people will abuse it, was basically the politics from the time I was a teenager up until I was in my 30s. So I'm wondering if that was also kind of an influence of yours, where it's not, you're not like, what's the word? You're not conscientiously thinking of people that way. But now I look back and I was like, yep, that's kind of the tone that I went with.
Yeah, we moved to the South, you know, and that was the first time that I was really surrounded by anyone who wasn't just a white Mesa Mormon, Scottsdale Mormon. And those prejudices certainly flavored a lot of my experience in the South. Yeah, things like people who would drive a Mercedes and live in a mobile home. And I couldn't just look at that as cultural or as privilege. It's just like, well, that's black people and they're evil and they don't have the gospel in their lives. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. They're gonna, you know, they're not as smart, things like that. I was just chronically racist. I never looked at somebody of another skin color as equal to me. That flavored a lot of everything.
I came across this on Reddit the other day that I thought would be interesting to read with you.
And oh, I haven't seen this.
So yeah, so it says, D. Todd Christofferson's wife has some advice for black people. So this is an apostle of the church's wife who, you know, sometimes it's interesting to see what the apostles, what they kind of think, what their families believe about cultural subjects, about people of different races, so forth, you know, behind the curtain when it's not approved by church PR, like kind of what they're saying. His wife says this, this is a Medium article somebody posted on Facebook that says 20 actions white people and non-black people of color can take to show up for black people right now. And she writes, I agree with most of the points in this paper with two exceptions. However, since I have never not walked in their shoes, I'm willing to admit that I might be wrong on those two. I did read the book in the 60s called Black Like Me, which was very informative and would be appreciated by the people of color community today. I really ought to sit down at the table. We really ought to sit down at the table together and start discussing on how we can bring all sides together in unity. And keep in mind, she says, I've never walked in their shoes. That's like an important admission, but it doesn't do a lot of work, in my opinion, just to say like, we should do this, or like, I haven't walked in their shoes. There's not like something actionable there that I really care about. So then she goes on to say, I will say this, we had dinner several months ago with a wonderful group of Black ministers of other faiths from out of state, and I really appreciated the opportunity to interface with them. I felt like they were a great source of light to the communities they serve, like inner city LA, and I told them so. They have challenges I can't even relate to, but we've prayed for them, and I think of them often. Dad and I have talked about showing our support for the Black community by giving good donations to the Negro College Fund. I think that's the name of it, not trying to be offensive by not using the term Black. I read what he said, but I still have reservations for giving this a full thumbs up. I do think that the police system needs a major overhaul, and I do think that there is a lot of discrimination against Blacks. So his frustration, especially on a very personal level, I see as justified, but we do really need to get together. We do really need to get over the slave issue. If they only see themselves as victims, they will never get over this. The Jews have been victims of discrimination to the point of having 6 million of them killed in the Holocaust, but they have moved beyond that.
They shouldn't.
I don't think that what's going on in Gaza right now shows that they have, but even though so much discrimination to their ethnicity still persists, some discrimination, we must open a dialogue with other races for sure, but some old issues need to be buried now.
I cannot believe that Sister Christofferson thing. I haven't seen that. My primary thought, just you reading that, is that this is what supremacy looks like. And I did a video this week where I talk about the three different flavors of white supremacy. Yes, there's the neo-Nazis. And what they want is they want to kill everybody. They want the Holocaust. They want to exterminate everybody that's just not like the white pure ancestry. Yeah, there's those guys out there, but they're very small in numbers. The second flavor, the second group is those who are more like, you know, let's vote against their rights. Let's make sure that they never have access to things. Mm-hmm. This is more innocuous. This is what's in the White House right now. MAGA, yeah, they're not going to go out and like, I don't know, like so far they haven't murdered anybody, but they are doing, they're deporting people. ICE is dragging people down the streets, right? So that's a big part, but it's still not the hugest portion of white supremacists. The majority of white supremacists fall under what you and I were, and this was that we're going to win them with love. I believed that if I had my little friend in second grade, well, she was my friend, the girl that was in my second grade class, who was an immigrant, I believed that if she came to church, got baptized as Mormon and became righteous and took on like the flavor and the culture and the clothing and started speaking English, that she would turn white because that's what the Mormon church taught us. I thought that was magic. Like, wow, if my Mexican friend get baptized, then they're going to become white just like me. And I believed that when Black people and Mexicans and everybody died, that they were going to be white and blonde-haired and blue-eyed, just like me and like Heavenly Father and Adam and Eve. And I wasn't trying to harm anybody. I was always just trying to convert them. Like, I want all of the people to come to church and accept Jesus Christ and stop cussing and smoking and, you know, and celebrating the Day of the Dead, which is the devil's holiday. That's a big thing down here in Arizona. Like, if they will just join the church and stop celebrating the devil's holiday, then they can become sons and daughters of Heavenly Father and they can live in the celestial kingdom forever. Amen and amen. And that seems sweet. And it seems like I just wanted to help people, but it's disgusting and despicable, and it's still white supremacy. And that's what most people in America are. Most people in America don't want anybody dead. A lot of them do want them deported, and they do want to take away rights and, you know, healthcare and opportunity and things like that. But most Americans just want, like, you know, let's stop eating Mexican food and let's just eat white people food, hamburgers, French fries, I don't know, a cup full of lard. Like, what is even American food? Stop playing your Mexican music at the park and just, you know, put on some, I don't know, Chris Tomlin or something. Let's not have Bad Bunny at the Super Bowl. Let's have Erica Kirk host a concert full of white people. That's the white supremacy. And that's what Sister Christofferson really, you know, she just comes across as that, like, I'm better. I'm this light. And you know that she was thinking, we were doing these guys a big favor by having them come and meet with us, these inner city pastors. Mm-hmm. And I told them they're doing a good job. Like, her telling people that they're doing a good job is some big favor. Like, look at me. Yeah. I'm the wife of an apostle. And I gave them a pat on the back and a thumbs up.
I have Black ex-Mormon friends. Spencer Nugent is one I've interviewed on my channel that comes to mind. And he was like devoutly like MAGA listening to Sean Hannity and all of that. Actually, now I'm out. And he talks about his deconstruction process. And the various Black people that I have talked to in the ex-Mormon community who used to be of the other kind of persuasion, you know what they call themselves? I'm saying that speaking on behalf of what they would say, they said that they were tokenized and they enjoyed being tokenized because it gave them a type of prowess, a type of power within the structures of white supremacy. And so in that way, like we have to separate people who within structures that seek to marginalize people, people within the margins will try to circumvent that by gaining access to power, by making friends with people who seek to disenfranchise them. That is just kind of the way that the world works. And so you're like, oh, if it's a lesbian who's against LGBTQ issues, if it's a lesbian who's, you know, mm-hmm. on this one side, then that means that they're the ones who are speaking truth to power. It's like, not
if it's a woman who's leaning into trad wife life and saying we should all just stay home. Yeah. Spencer's the reason that I'm not racist as much as I am not racist today, by the way, because we started collaborating on lives and stuff. And so we became real life friends. And like, I've been to his house and stuff. So I was just texting Spencer this morning. I'm on Kara's show. I didn't realize that I was still like, I left the church and I don't believe in that. And Spencer and I had like fights over the phone where he would say, Jenny, you are fucking racist. Like, Jenny, you can't think that. You can't say that. Oh, and I'm just over here like, but I hold on a second. Like, I didn't know that. Like, really? So then I'm like reading books and I'm calling like college professors, like, well, tell me about the civil rights. And like, I was asking everyone, like, how is this racist? And then, but I was reaching out to my other Black friends because in ex-Mormon world, there's a lot of Black ex-Mormons. And yeah, Spencer gave me like the tough love that I need by just telling me you are a racist. And here's specifically why, because of this conversation that we just had.
That's recent. And,
yeah. Oh yeah.
In the last couple years. If I went back into my own mind, I was completely oblivious and had total cognitive dissonance about structures and levers of power and how now I am obsessed mm-hmm. with systems and what systemic racism means that I was told doesn't exist. That, you know, I was told by Ben Shapiro that a Black man who leaves his baby mama, that he did he have a gun to his head that he had to leave? Like, no, the problems of the Black community are completely their own fault of their own making, thinking that they were just morally inferior to white people. And it had nothing to do with any other systems and any other policies that put people in the positions that they're in. Like, I looked at individual responsibility as the end all be all, that like anybody can feel the spirit from a missionary knocking on their door and it's up to them to be receptive of it or not. It is up to, you know, everybody who is in poverty to just work two jobs and make the money so that they can eke out a living. And if somebody is a billionaire who's exploiting them and taking portions of their wage under, you know, whatever policies that we have in the country, like, just let it be. Like, individual responsibility all day. I was not able to look at the systems of power as they are.
That's on you.
And yeah.
You live in a trailer. That's on you. You can't take care of your family. That's on you. Your life sucks. That's on you. We weren't taught to look at the systems though, because we were told that the system was just leaning into Heavenly Father and being a good person and being righteous. And if you did that, then life was going to be magical. And a lot of what you're describing is we had blinders on around privilege. We weren't capable of seeing that it was actually privilege that was lifting up our whole lives. And that privilege, that thing right there, that's what everybody's trying to protect. People that are racist, white supremacy is trying to encapsulate and safeguard that privilege moving forward into the future. Because these, you know, as a white mom, I wanted my white kids to be able to live in million-dollar homes and run successful businesses and have all the babies that they wanted. I fought against everybody else because I wanted to protect that little nugget, that little bubble of privilege that was around my family and around future generations. That's really all it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you just, either you don't notice it as the privilege that it is that there are systems in place that allowed you to live in the life that you have. Like, I'm okay with, like, I remember being a conservative kind of trad wife when I was having my babies and my husband was going to school at the U, and it was some of the happiest times of my entire life. All of us moms at the student family housing, we all came outside at the playground and we all raising our babies. And what I thought was so interesting is that we were all really conservative, but we all were on food stamps. And I also knew that we all simultaneously voted to restrict Medicaid, restrict food stamps, that if we all had our way, there wouldn't be any kind of safety net for poor people. That's just what we believed was, you know, righteous and from God. And that's the way the country should run. But while it's here, we'll use it anyway. And I don't know why that disconnect happened for like all 100 of us. But the idea that I could take away somebody's only access to putting food on the table for their kids came from a place of privilege, because I knew that my family, who had generational wealth because of our skin color, the reasons in which the, like, my husband's grandparents were extremely wealthy in Arizona had to do with the color of their skin amongst their other, you know, hardworking capabilities, like their access to people within the church having different callings and being bankers, and their access to money that now I know that will take care of me, is just not the story for other people. When I would be so easily, I would lose sleep at night taking, you know, if I had to push the button as a conservative 10 years ago, mm-hmm. if it was up to me to take away any kind of safety net and Social Security income for anybody who I thought didn't deserve it, I wouldn't lose sleep at night because of my privilege. And that's where it's annoying that it's kind of become a meme of like, well, check your privilege. It is really like, legitimately check your privilege, because not everybody has a system behind them that is giving them the kind of access that I have been afforded at this time. Like,
I never checked my privilege, and a lot of my followers are like, oh, Jenny, it's amazing that like you've come around and now you fight for, you know, I run a homeless nonprofit and I'm a spokesperson for a women's domestic violence housing nonprofit and things like that. Oh, Jenny, you're so enlightened. No, I wasn't enlightened. So Kara, I lost everything. 4 days after my 24-year marriage ended, my husband cleaned out the bank account and I couldn't afford a $43 bag of groceries at Trader mm-hmm. Joe's. And it was 10 months until I was homeless. I was sleeping in my car. And I would still be sleeping in my car if I hadn't had a family member help me out. But I also came from intergenerational poverty on one side. And my family just wasn't, like, we didn't have that privilege. I was kind of first generation. Like, me and my ex-husband were kind of self-made. And so I didn't have that safety net. And I saw for the first time, oh, this is what it's like to fucking not have privilege. This is what it looks like to mm-hmm. not have that intergenerational wealth. This is what it looks like to have that very fragile privilege, which is why Ballerina Farm Hannah Neeleman makes me so mad, because she's selling a lifestyle where she has a safety net that most women will never have. And I've heard from those women. I've heard from thousands of women who have escaped domestic violence who reach out to me, and the stories are sad. I think one of the saddest was like a 70-year-old grandma who is disabled. She's had both hips replaced, and she lives in her daughter's basement in California. And she's like, I work at Walgreens and, you know, my body aches. I thought that at this point in my life, I'd be retired with grandberry bees, just enjoying my life. But she got divorced late in life. Her husband left her at like 65, and she lives in abject poverty. And she's like, and I can't afford my prescriptions and my Medicaid doesn't cover everything. And she doesn't have that safety net that Hannah Neeleman and other truly privileged people have. So I came face to face with, oh, if you don't have that type of privilege, then here's how shitty your life can get in mm-hmm. the blink of an eye.
The story that you just described of being so destitute, which breaks my heart, and I'm so grateful that I have. I've been on the edge. About 1 year ago, I saw, you know, when your phone does like 1 year ago today, I was mm-hmm. playing the saxophone. I was playing some blues, and I was like, man, when I get out of this divorce, man, I'm going to play the blues so well. I looked like trash. I was just like, I literally had like $2 in my bank account for like months on end, you know, like that feeling of
so I had nothing in my bank account for 5 years while also struggling with an anoxic brain injury, because during the faith reconstruction and the divorce, then I tried to end my life. That's why I'm called Life Take Two. I woke up 10 hours later from the coma. I was rescued by a neighbor girl who heard my Mercedes in my garage, and I survived. So I went 6 years. I've only actually been able to pay my rent every month since October. Last October, Brittany Hartley, when my TikTok demonetized, had to do a fundraiser. Well, she didn't have to. She did a fundraiser for me to pay my rent.
Wow.
That's how messed up. Yeah. Health problems.
Go you.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a system. And yeah, it's unreliable men. Do you know this statistic that 70%, no, we have a 70% major catastrophe rate while we are married with children at home. So that's divorce. While you're raising kids, you're married, you have kids at home, 70% chance of divorce, death, disability, job loss of your primary caretaker. And then that also factors in natural disasters. Like maybe you live in the Palisades in California and your house burns down. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a pandemic that shuts things down. You have a 70% chance of divorce, death, disability, job loss of the primary caretaker, and other extraneous disasters that can destroy your life. Right. Childhood poverty right now is something like 36%. It's ridiculous to think that we get married and we spend all this money on the wedding. Like, I'm sure you had a beautiful wedding. Well, you got married in the temple, right? You had a lovely reception, and then you didn't spend any money on putting away a spousal trust, on making sure that you had your education so that you should support yourself.
A man was the plan. That's it.
Yeah, I think I coined that phrase. I'm the first one that ever said that, by the way. A man is not a plan. That was during the pandemic. Okay. I have that similar picture of myself that just popped up in my Facebook. Like, it's just been my 7 year anniversary. This was me 7 years ago last week, right after my marriage crumbled. And this was like the day that I went to Trader Joe's and the whole huge nest egg, the retirement, everything had been cleaned out of the bank account, shut down. And I never recuperated any of that in the divorce. I got nothing in the divorce. I got zero in the divorce. And my life was unraveling.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah.
That laying in bed crying. Ooh. So Kara, and that shouldn't happen. You should get divorced and you should just go through a breakup. Like, I'm sad. This is hard, but you should still be able to pay for your home and you should still be able to provide for your kids and not have such a major upheaval at our age. Not our age. You're 20 years younger than me, but
yeah,
these toxic systems.
Yeah. These are the toxic systems in which people of varying levels of privilege, you kind of don't really know what you have till it's gone. And then there are thankfully amazing people within the community that can sometimes help out, whether it's mutual aid or what have you. So right now you seem to be doing glowing and lovely and beautiful, and your channel is like ultra popular, putting out a message that I think is really important and resonating with people.
Thank you.
It is very difficult to not know how to make money for yourself. Like, you are very inspirational that you're able to speak your mind and people are receptive to it. And, you know, you can make a living off of doing what you do. And I'm always struggling to do that myself. But the fact that I was never prepared to make a plan outside of a man is the biggest, you know, wake up call of my lifetime. So my sister's been really supportive, and she had to undo the wiring of her anti-feminism on my behalf over the last couple of years. and now she's like the most outspoken, beautiful feminist. And she teaches me so many things. And the one point that she always comes back to for me is that feminism, the way that like anti-feminists, the way that like conservatives so often make it out to seem, that like, it's just these people want to take away rights from men, And she says how feminism is a response to unreliable men. Feminism is not a response to good men. It's a response to the reality of what men are. And if every man was a great man that was just reliable as the day is long, we wouldn't really need feminism as much as we have it right now. But feminism is just a response to unreliable and incompetent men in a society. That's the nicest way I can put it, basically. One of my final questions is, if you could speak directly to somebody who's still deep in racism, devout religious beliefs, somebody who is still very certain that all of this connects them with their God, the same things that you kind of believed. If you had one final message, what are the kind of things, if you could speak directly to those type of people, what would you say, if there is anything to say?
I would say what I wish that somebody would have said to me, like when I was 19 or 26 or something. I wish that somebody had told me to take a little break from everything that I'd been raised with. You know how the Amish, they have that, what's the word? Like they take that little year. Yeah, the Rumspringen. I think it's really important for everybody, whatever, whether you're in a religion or, you know, you just, this is your diet, like you're vegetarian or whatever. If you have a way of being, which we all do, it's important to take a little break for a while, you know, go backpack Europe, go down to Mexico for the year and, you know, volunteer doing something in a hospital or something, like take that little break so that you can give yourself space to listen to your own inner voice. And that's honestly what happened to me when I was going through my divorce and everything. I had this forced time when I was homebound, I was bedbound. I'd get up and do a little TikTok video every day. And I started to really look at the world around me and I was able to compare, like, is this really what I feel? Is this what I really think about other people? Or are these things that I've just been taught that I accept as my own ideas? And when I took that break, you know, no contact when you're in a bad relationship and like, let's just cool it for a minute. We're going to separate.
That's really good advice.
No contact. Yes. That no contact opened me up to listening to my own voice and hearing myself and also just try new things. I think that's good for anything. Again, if you're in a relationship, like, you know, go to a different restaurant once in a while, go on a vacation somewhere that you've never been to see if you can like recuperate that relationship that's getting kind of stale. Our relationship with our ideologies, our relationship with our religions, our relationship with our politics and with the world around us, we need to do things to infuse new life in them. If I had done some of those things, I might have woken up sooner and seen the path that I was on was, again, like I started the show with this, it was separating me from people around me. It was separating me from myself. It was separating me from my community. And
yeah, really let me pause you on that. I really want to make sure people do not miss that. List the things that you just said again, that being so fed a diet of your Mormon kind of white supremacy of what you, your brain was just still chowing down on the same old things without taking a break. It separated you from yourself, you said, from your community. And then what was the other thing you said?
Individuals around me.
Individuals around you. Mm-hmm. And that is so important. If I, my mission statement, basically with what I want to do with my channel, with my voice, is make people connect back to those things. And if you can know yourself and tap into yourself, be friends with the people in your community, serve the people in your community, no matter what they look like, how they vote, but you serve them because community is all we're really going to have, and individuals like, around us.
Yeah.
Like that is so important to take space from people who seek to divide us, which is really what I think the online sphere right now is all about with the algorithms, and tap into that. So continue with your thought. Sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off your thought, but I think this
thank you so much.
This is like 20 times better of an answer than I even thought you were going to give. And I was already very impressed. So continue.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, thank you so much. Everything that you say, like, makes me think so much. On the topic of the individuals that I was separated from, you can never, ever go back and redo the past. And I think as a 51-year-old grandma who lived like this for so long, I have so much regret because of that separation from people around me. My grandmother was a non-member, and I was taught to hate her, and I jumped on that hate bandwagon my whole entire life. And now she's dead. And now I've left the church. And now I look back and I see, like, just because she wore tank tops and a push-up bra as a grandma, by the way, she was hot. That didn't make her a bad, evil person. Just because she went to the Lutheran church instead of the Mormon church, just because she had a coffee pot, there were people around me that these individuals in my life, I was triangulated against by my religion and my ideology. And Kara, there's like not a week that goes by that I don't have grief over the missed relationship with that individual. In fact, okay, my little jewelry box that I have like I have all my little treasures here in this jewelry box. This is my grandmother's, I think they call it the red badge of courage. I know that some other people have told me that I've said that wrong. This is her red lipstick from like World War One. This was the color that she used to wear, that when she passed away, somebody sent me her lipstick. I will never get that relationship with my grandma back. I'll never be able to just be curious about her and connect with her without looking at her through the filter of an evil satanic Lutheran who wore tank tops. The mm-hmm. only thing that I have left of my grandma to relate with is her lipstick, and that's sad. And I have so many regrets like that, where I look back and it's like, I was terrible with these people, or I just never got to have experiences because I was in my little bubble doing my church stuff and hating on the world. I had an experience just about 2 months ago where Kevin and I, we have this huge, beautiful farmer's market within walking distance here in Tucson. And we walked over the farmer's market, and now like have deconstructed so much stuff. And I approach the world with this openness and curiosity. And I just want to connect with everyone around me. I'm not judging anymore. I'm not like, that person has tattoos and all lesbians holding hands. So I'm walking the farmer's market, and yes, we passed lesbians, and I live in Tucson, Arizona. White people are the minority by far. People speaking all kinds of different languages. Some of my neighbors are Indian. Of course, we have a lot of, a huge Mexican population here in Tucson. And I was able to just look at people and talk to people. And some of our friends were at the market, and they're all so diverse and different and beautiful. And it was the first time in my life, Kara, that I've ever felt just truly connected to the human experience, just marveling at, you know, the different hairstyles and the way people, you know, the things that they buy, and some of the vendors at the market, the things that they make that are so different than maybe who I am. And it was the first time that I would have gone to a farmer's market and not been judging. I just left the Christian church 2 years ago, by the way. Mormonism mm-hmm. was 7 years ago. I just broke up with Jesus 2 years ago. So just to be there and not like, well, they don't look like they're Christian. And again, like lesbians, oh, all of these Mexicans, like why is the market overrun with Mexicans and food from other countries? I think there are people from Greece that sell like the Greek pastries and stuff. I was so overwhelmed with that feeling of connection, that feeling of just being on this big, beautiful earth with all the interesting mm-hmm. expressions of humanity. And it was like life-changing. And now I just soak that up, like just the connection to other people. I don't have to understand why you do your hair that way, or why that's the food that you eat, or how you structure your families, or whoever. I'm over here doing my thing, and you're over there doing your thing. And that curiosity and connection with other humans is the most beautiful thing I've ever experienced. And it makes me mad that I missed out on that for 50 years of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right on. That reminds me of one of the times where I was on Mormon Stories with John Larson, and we had an episode about why ex-Mormons are so angry. And the part that made me cry and get the most angry about my experience was how much it put a barrier, like you described, between me and not just my family member who are believers, who believe that I am, you know, a daughter, son of perdition right now, but like how much it hurts my heart to think that I spent so long in such isolated hatred without the beautiful, like, an all-enveloping love for myself, and the love that you're describing for like humanity at large. The fact that like so many people miss out on what life is really about and can't tap into that because they're just so in their hatred, and they think that that's righteousness. They think that that's of God. And if there is a God, it's anything but that. Like that is whatever, you know, Satanism would be. It would be, how do we separate? How do we hate each other and see each other as other, and try to put ourselves in a hierarchy above them? And yeah, that's the topic that I hope people can kind of think about within themselves as they listen to this podcast, because we are just two blonde broads. We haven't gone that far off of the deep end, to be honest. Like, I don't think we're saying anything that too lefty extreme right now. It's just like people seek to divide us and capitalize on our mm-hmm. division and our hatred and our fear. And like, I'm not about that life. I'm just, you're not about that life, not about that life. So I refuse to hate my countrymen. I refuse to hate humanity. I think that we all have beauty and things to offer and give. And there's an egalitarian, pluralistic society I have in my mind that we might not get to, but I want to do everything that I can within my circle of influence to speak about how I'm implementing it and talk to other people like you about how you've reformed. So this
amen
is
that.
Amen. Amen all day. So Jenny Gage, yeah, I'm so, so grateful for your channel, and I hope people go send you lots of love and subscribe over at your channel. I'll leave the link down below. Life Takes Two. Send Jenny lots of love, not death threats. Anyone sending a death threat, I threaten you with death. I'll tell you that much. So treat Jenny well. People can follow you on where? Instagram, TikTok as well.
I'm mostly on YouTube. So I'm on YouTube all day, every day. I do go on my TikTok to do some lives. I have some senators and famous authors and different personalities that I bring over on my lives from time to time on my TikTok, but I'm mostly over on YouTube right now. And if you are in Canada, my CBC documentary just dropped this week, and I'll give you that link that you can put in the description. So it's called Big Feminist Energy, and it's supposed to be absolutely amazing. I've been part of the production and everything, of course, like they came and videoed me, but I haven't seen it yet. So my Canadian viewers, I highly recommend it. The Fenish Project supposedly is absolutely amazing, and it really dives into women's role in society and why we do everything that we do. So
incredible. And so if we get the link to that, people can watch it online. Mm-hmm. Like, great, exciting. And then you mentioned
Canada. I think it'll Canada be a couple weeks for the Americans to watch it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Americans, we always have to play second fiddle to our hat neighbors. And then you mentioned running some nonprofits. Is there any way that people can support you with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a link to that. I have a video where I explain, and I just run a small personal nonprofit that I like people to duplicate in their own way across the country. I can help you get set up. I call it Neighbors Without Walls, and it's a micro approach to addressing homelessness. And that's I'll give you those links so that people can support that. But ideally, what I want people to do is find a couple of homeless individuals near you that are your neighbors without walls, that you can support and help rehabilitate in your local community. So I don't typically ask for donations every once in a while. I do super chats on my family or on my super chats on my channel that go towards the two 26-year-old unhoused individuals that I am currently sheltering and helping to rehabilitate. But I want people to go out into the world and do their own thing in their own community, because that's what it's all about. We want to rebuild our local tribes as much as we can.
Love, 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 love that. Because there was such an abstract idea about like what community was when I was Mormon and being ex-Mormon. But where I live now, I'm really more interested in what everybody has something that you can do in your own community. There is something you can do, whether it's just getting, you know, meeting, making sure that you meet your neighbors is like step one when you're such an introvert like me. That's me now. But yeah, I love anything that can help people have hands-on, realistic problem-solving approaches.
Fight tribal decay. That tribal decay is destroying us. So yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Get in there and rebuild your local tribe. And the more we build back our villages, the better everything is going to be. Like, that's the secret, Kara. That's it right there.
Yeah. Well done on making it through such a hellish experience and being such a bright blonde balayage for me to enjoy right now, and all of us to hear your words of wisdom. All right. Well, thank you to Jenny, and thank you to my cat for walking in the frame right now. Thumbs up for my cat, Benny, for being the fame whore that he is and joining us at the end of this video. Make sure that you hit the subscribe button down below. I'm looking for more donors to my channel, and recurring donations help out a lot. A lot of people have moved out of the space because I haven't made very much content in the last little bit. So replacing those donors is what I really need to do. So $5 or $10 a month on Patreon or DonorBox. I also have a Venmo link down below. So I want to keep making this content as much as I can and trying to make it sustainable and pay for cat food, neuter this cat, and pay for the vet bill. As much as I would love to have little kittens with this mug on it. All right. Thanks. Love you, everybody. Bye.